Would you introduce yourselves, please?
We're John the Martyr. I'm Kyle Ridley.
I'm Dustin DeSalvo.
I'm the front man, Bill Hudson. John the Martyr.
The front man. I like that. As opposed to the inside man. So let's see. We got your Harlem. We got your Apollo Theater. We got your New Orleans. We got your Subway. We got Spice. We got Church. We got all sorts of stuff. So we got a stew going here. Now we have to take that stew and we need to make sense of it. Bill, we're going to go with you and then we're going to work back to New Orleans. Talk to me about Harlem back. I mean, we've all read about it. We know this stuff. But your version of this stuff, age 10, do you remember the first concert?
My first concert was at Central Park. The Budweiser.
The Budweiser
series, summer concerts. I used to get on the rock. That's when, you know, the Beatniks, you know, Free Love, boom, that type of situation. We're sitting on a rock. We didn't have to pay. You know, Spiral.
What was the corner in Harlem? What was your home? Where were you?
Harlem, 140th Street, 7th and 8th Avenue.
Wow, that was interesting territory.
Yeah, very interesting. Along just shortly after the Harlem Renaissance, you know, where, you know, the whole influx of musicians came through. I was too young at the time to, you know, actually get into, you know, admission-wise, to get into some of the places. But we used to tiptoe and the Round Table, the Baby Grand, the Top Club. These were all the landmark places in Harlem. And
you'd kind of put your ear to the ground there, or ear to the wall, and kind of absorb
the
sounds.
Just to get a glimpse of some of the people I read and heard about, you know, and so forth.
So were you sheltered, or were you right smack dab, pun intended, in the middle of the insanity?
140th Street is the nest egg of the good and the bad. Right around the corner, I lived on 141st Street. 139th Street, one block over, was Stryver's Row. I don't know if you ever heard of Stryver's Row. It was the townhouses and the townhouses with doctors, a professional block.
Right.
And so, but on the other side, I had friends who were, you know, their life got entangled with the drugs. I saw, you know, the drug dealers. I saw
So you really got both sides of the fence.
I got both sides of the fence, and I was lured and was enticed by the, I guess you would call it, bad side. And those people became my heroes, so to speak.
When you first walked in that room and you sucked in the air, did you know at that moment in time we'd be sitting here in a weird lounge in a Hilton hotel?
I'll take it. I'll come with it from the back door entrance. I didn't walk into the Apollo. Around 10, 11 years old, the Apollo was cost about $2.50. You know, me and a group of guys, we didn't have the $2.50, so there were some ushers who were trying to make a little side money. We go around the back of the Apollo, knock on the door, and run upstairs. We give him his dollar, run upstairs. Now all the other ushers trying to find out who just got in. But bottom line, many of the artists that I wanted to see, we saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show back in the day. My aunt, in terms of my family, my aunt, they used to have a thing called the Harvest Moon Ball, which was the dance contest. She, and they had the winners appear there. So I saw my aunt. I was bitten by, at a very young age, the entertainment field. I saw on the Ed Sullivan Show, we all gathered around on a Sunday and watched that. So I had the bug.
So you were watching The Temptations and you were watching Sam
Four
and Dave.
Tops, Motown, Sam and Dave, Barry White, Jackson 5 before they hit it big. Everybody came through. Maxine Brown, Ray Charles, Slappy White. Amateur Night, which was on a Wednesday, was held on a Wednesday. But the Amateur Night, it was a bonus. In other words, you got to see the main liner, the headliner, which was James Brown or, you know, Sly and the Family Stone. But at the same time, prior to them coming on, there was Amateur Night. And if you brought it, you had to bring it correct at the Apollo, because they used to have Sandman. You used to call him Sandman. He had the hook. And, you know, matter of fact, Sandman played in the Hoofers with Sammy Davis Jr. Gregory Hines. That was at Motown, the Hoofers. But Sandman was there, and he got his name because he used to throw sand on the floor.
Right.
But what happened is that if he wasn't good,
you were out.
You were out.
Yeah, Nile Rodgers told me that story about coming on and being in the pit. Yeah, and like you had hit a wrong note, and oh boy.
Oh no.
To skip a bunch of years. You were part of this Subway series, this Artist in the Subway series. And next thing you know, these guys from New Orleans, so over to them, what were you doing in New York hanging out in the subway? Looking for musicians.
I was just taking the subway.
Because you had a New Orleans, you had a New Orleans act that was doing its thing.
I moved to, I'd lived in Austin, L.A., and then been in New York for just 6 months, and just got there and was taking the subway just to get around. And I saw the doo-wop groups on the train a few times, and also saw them around Herald Square and Union Square and stuff like that. And just started looking up videos of them on YouTube. And I remember seeing Spank, and Spank being like the prominent one. Right. And I really wanted to record something with these guys.
Did you know you were looking for something? Did you know that you needed a bill in what you were doing at that moment in time?
Not really. I just wanted doo-wop vocals on some interesting things I was trying to work on and that I thought would be cool to mix the clash.
And you didn't know what that thing was yet. Had it formed in any way, shape, or form?
No, where it really, I think, first hit was once the guys, I used to have a little scam going in the back of Guitar Center where I...
Ah, the famous guitar. I remember those days. I read about that, the famous Guitar Center scam.
They were just prorating rental equipment for me, so I would turn their lessons rooms in the back into like a two-hour studio. Really good mics and stuff. So I got Spank to come, didn't know the guys that well, met Bill outside. We went in and just recorded a few hooks to different songs, and one of them was Feeling Good, which I only had the chorus and like one verse for. But one of the guys, I think Herm, the band leader, said, or one of the members, he said, Bill, you should take lead on that. One of them said that, and Bill sang lead on the verse, and I wasn't expecting that, and that's where I first was.
And how did you manage to get away with poaching Bill from Spank?
Hearn gave me Bill's number, and Bill wasn't, I think, right, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't exclusively, he was gigging, and he was doing all kinds of different things. So I just said, do you want to collaborate? I have some original material, and, you know, been jamming in New Orleans a lot with my friend Dustin, and so he said, yeah, we'll check it out. And so we just kept meeting regularly and going over lyrics, but not really having any idea where it was going. It was just kind of hanging out.
You see him in the subway, you get permission to hang with him, you know, sans Spank. And then you have to figure out what this is, right? You have a pile of songs, you now have a new lead singer, you have a band with a lot of killer musicians. That you've obviously, how many of those billion people did you have at that moment in time?
Yeah, I think the band didn't really come, so.
So give me the trajectory.
Yeah, so.
You meet Bill in the subway and then.
So then I would say it was probably a few months of meeting up regularly and recording just into my MacBook, whether it be at Guitar Center or some basement somewhere. And we were just recording kind of demos, making sure we could get the vocals down. But then I would say when the first step to like actually doing something live, because Bill was like, yo, this is fun, but I'm kind of sick of singing into a computer.
Quote of the day.
So I think the first step for that, my brother was graduating and Dustin came up. So I'll switch it to his perspective.
Yeah, Dustin, come on.
Hey.
It's your turn.
To pick up really where Kyle just left off. I remember it was my first time coming to New York for his brother's graduation at West Point.
Now, from New Orleans?
Yeah, from New Orleans.
Okay.
And him and I have been jamming in the attic of my parents' garage for the past 5-6 years.
See, Bill, you could have gotten out of the computer and gotten into the attic.
So he picks me up from the airport, and he's like, I have a surprise. And I'm like, I'm just thinking in my head.
What could it be?
What is the surprise going to be? And we get in the car, and he plugs his phone in naturally, start playing some music. But I had heard a lot of the stuff he was making on his computer before, and as soon as I heard what was about to play, I knew this was the surprise. And then after Bill's voice hit, I was like, oh, this is definitely the surprise. And
one would think.
Yeah. And we had a great trip. We talked about it. We went and saw TV on the Radio that night and everything. It was a really cool.
Now, there's an interesting reference for John the Martyr, TV on the radio. Yeah. Dig that.
We were, you know, we talked about it, and Kyle was like, move up. And so wound up moving up here. And then I remember the first time I met Bill was naturally in Guitar Center.
Of course.
And so we went, and there was a song that Kyle had written that when he was living in Austin, that when he would ever come back to New Orleans, we would flesh out instrumentally. Taken back by it, and like, this is
what moving forward is going to be the filter for a John the Martyr song. How are you going to know it's a John the Martyr song?
I mean, I can tell you one answer. It's Bill Hudson.
In terms of, as far as I'm concerned, it's an old definition. Music is sound pleasing to the ear. It defies, especially, you know, I don't know, I'm from a soul R&B background, Stax background. When people try to pigeonhole into the genre thing and commercially, that's where it's supposed to be, either or. It's an eclectic gumbo of multicultural talents. That's all in it. To put a label on it and then restrict it to, it's how, like I said last night, music don't come from you, it comes through you. And if you're to reach people in the audience, you're just a vehicle for your music that you're feeling amongst all of us to get to reach them. And if you're not reaching them, then whatever the message of the lyrics is, it might be all for naught, you know, because as far as I'm concerned. I just want to piggyback that same thought, and I've expressed this to Kyle so many times. What's important is, piggybacking what you're saying, when Kyle is writing a song and he gives me some lyrics, and there are so many different ways that it can be received and understood by your audiences. So, Kyle, what did you mean by this? What was you thinking?
There you go. Right. And that's important. That's actually really important, is translating the meaning behind what you're writing.
And that's how we got to know each other, was through the lyrics. Like, we weren't meeting up and having conversations, where you from, what we would talk about lyrics, and that would lead into talking about life and experiences and stuff like that.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then you get to pick anything you want in between. This is not a playlist.